Okay. As you may have heard, I managed to squeeze enough time from my email correspondence to finish grading the exams. In fact, I finished the last, there were five I didn't know I had until this morning, and I finished grading those over the noon hour. So I'm assuming that Sue is collating them and getting the checklists and the comment sheets all bundled up so that they're ready to be distributed. What I will do when I leave here is to find out from her what method we're going to use to distribute them. I'm thinking I may just come down here at 4, or I may come down sooner or something like that, and just have a place where you can come and get them. Whatever that'll be this afternoon sometime, and I just have to get with her to find out the easiest way to do the distribution. Cafferty. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's not like they're going away. It's just most people are understandably anxious to get them as soon as possible. So I'm going to try to just do it as efficiently and avoiding having 4,000 people hovering over Sue Cartwright's desk, Faraka, I mean, her desk to distribute them. Mr. Clark. Well, we could have a very interesting discussion. I just was spanked. I'm not always the best behaved citizen of this community, but it's a difficult area to. For one thing, I think there is a legitimate concern about abuse of power. That, you know, those of us who have tenure, who pass out grades, you know, we're in a position to do things that people on the other end of the power curve feel unable to do. And moreover, they're paying dearly, for my privilege to do this. And I certainly understand that sentiment. And as I tried to say in my follow-up email, I didn't do my first round in as deft a way as I could have. As a student just told me, a student who's very cordial, we go back a long way, and he said, look, I like you and admire you and so forth. He said, I alone, but no. He said, I still don't like political messages, and he didn't appreciate it, and told me so, when I sort of explained what was going on, and he said, well, you should have had someone else send it out for you, and I said, good idea, you know, that would have been a smart way to go. But in any event, I hope this all comes to a happy resolution. I'm somewhat embarrassed, not that I'm unaccustomed to being at the center of some degree of contention, but it was certainly not my preference, since I'm about to hand out evaluations, and God only knows what price I will pay for that. In any event, any questions about exams or about, yes. Oh, good point. I don't know any of this stuff. I'm not supposed to know any of it, so I will depend on having Sue have a list of that so she can help you out. I assume the registrar's got a list that Sue could work off of so that if you forget it, she can give it to you. I might also read it. I'll hope to send you all an email. That contains the information about, you know, where it's going to be and where to go. It may be, for example, the registrar is the place you ask them, say, what number did I use? And they can say, you used this number. And then you take that number to wherever it is we're going to distribute. Other housekeeping types, questions? Okay. All right, so we nudged into this area last time on Wednesday of wrongful death. And as I said at the end of class on Wednesday, what we have now are two cases that just kind of walk us through a wrongful death evaluation, as it were. And the main thing I wanted you to come away with last Wednesday was the concept that, unlike areas even of tort damages, where the courts have over time fashioned and refashioned and tweaked and molded the measure of damages to correspond to some standard of balance or what have you, in the area of wrongful death, the process essentially was taken out of the hands of the courts and put into the hands of the legislature. And as I talked about at the end of class, there are these two basic questions that you want to ask when you confront this kind of a problem on the exam. Again, once you see that there is a wrongful death issue in an exam question, your instinct will be, give me the statute. And indeed, I will give you the statute as part of the exam package. And then your task will be to answer those two questions that I suggested are at the heart of every wrongful death statute. The first question is, who stands in line to benefit from the recovery? Who are the people the statute has identified, or what is the legal entity, or who are the people that the statute says deserves compensation? And the second question is, what do they get? What damages are enumerated among those that the beneficiaries are entitled to? And again, the legislature is free to pick among the alternatives the ones that seemed right to the legislature, and the court is stuck carrying out the will of the legislature. Although one of the things I think we want to notice is that the courts will try to err on the side of, well, generosity, or to put it another way, the courts will try to avoid a situation in which the remedy seems hopelessly inadequate. And we'll talk about some situations in which you could see the literal interpretation of the statute appearing to be just ridiculous. And the question is, then what? Do we just simply shrug our shoulders and say, go talk to the legislature? Or does the court look for a way to find a way around it? Okay, so let's first talk about First National Bank of Meadville versus Niagara Therapy. Somebody want to just review the facts and the legal atmosphere in which this was decided? All right, you're paying for it. I'll do it here. I'd rather give you a chance to do it yourselves, but here goes. Okay, here's the deal. Kenneth Rice gets killed in a plane crash. He's survived by his wife and his two daughters. The law that applies to his case, or to the family's case, is from Pennsylvania, and I want to insert a little parenthetical here that later on in civil procedure, I assume it's later on in civil procedure, you will look at, may already be talking about at least in preliminary terms, this idea of choice of law as a legal issue. So that if, for example, your company enters into a contract with a company in Colorado, the question will arise, well, whose contract law is used to decide that contract? Is it the law of Washington, where you live, where your company is located? Is the law of Colorado, where the company is located? Does it matter if there's something in the contract that addresses this issue? And then what happens if you have, for example, a tort case, a plane crash? Plane takes off from Spokane, headed for Denver, crashes in Idaho. Victims on board are from California. Planes manufactured in Minnesota. What law governs? So, obviously, if you're the plaintiff, you will do what is sort of negatively referred to as forum shopping. You'll go look for the body of law that's most favorable to your claim on such things as statute of limitations or measure of damages or other kinds of issues. And then the court has the difficult task of figuring out what law is going to be used to decide these questions. But here we have the law given to us. It's the law of Pennsylvania. Now, as I said earlier, what are the first two questions we want to ask about this statute? First question is, Ms. McLaughlin? And under Pennsylvania law, who benefits here? No good deed goes unpunished here. Yeah. Okay, so at least one part of the statute says, as I drew it on Wednesday, we have something called the wrongful death statute, which is for the benefit of the family. Mrs. Rice and the two daughters. But as it turns out, under Pennsylvania law, they also have, what's the alternative to a wrongful death statute? A survival statute. Again, what we mean here is that the cause of action survives. It's not the survival of the decedent. He's quite dead. But his cause of action did not die with him. Lawyers have a way of making things survive. Doctors can't do anything, but lawyers can. They can make his, what's really important, his cause of action survives. So that, in effect, his spirit, if you want to get kind of weird about it, lives on in the form of this lawsuit vindicating the wrong that was done to him. Now, again, oftentimes a legislature will choose one or the other as their primary paradigm, if you will, their model of understanding. So they say this is either to compensate the flesh and blood people whose loved one has been lost. They're the ones who are suffering. They're the ones who deserve to be compensated. Or the legislature will say, in effect, wait a minute, we could solve this simply by treating this cause of action as though it survived as an asset in the decedent's estate. So in the same way that the decedent may have died owning property or having stock or other kinds of assets that are then distributed by way of a will or some kind of statutory formula, so-called intestate succession, where there is no will. Whatever mechanism there is for distributing this decedent's assets, let's use that and simply add the case against the defendant as an asset to be distributed as the decedent chose or as the legislature provides for distribution. That's the way to solve this problem. So again, typically the legislature will choose this method or that method. Pennsylvania says, well, why not do both? Why not compensate each? Obviously, there's a risk of double recovery here, that we count the same loss in two different places. They want to avoid that. But there's a way in which, under this statute, you can say, in effect, Mr. Rice is like this goose that lays golden eggs. As far as the Mrs. Rice and the daughters are concerned, the defendant took away their goose. And they want a measurement. You know, we want to check out the history here. How many more eggs would Kenneth Rice have laid, and what would they have been worth? How big would they have been? Again, this goes to the question of the legislature's choice of what. So, as we choose who, and the legislature says, let's compensate both, don't double count it, but to the extent there is an identifiable loss to the wife and daughters, this is what Kenneth Rice would have brought home, but you killed him and now he can't. This is how much we're short. At the same time, there's the idea that not everything he earned in life would have been consumed by him or by his family. Some of it would have been left over and accumulated in what would have eventually been his estate. So let's figure out how much that would have been. And each one is entitled to compensation. As it turns out, in this case, the beneficiary of the estate, are exactly the same people as on the wrongful death side. But you can easily imagine a situation in which they're different. Suppose Mr. Rice had an estate plan, very different. Suppose he'd been having marital difficulties and he had drawn up a brand new will that now leaves all his money to somebody new, or suppose he leaves it all to the Humane Society or some other charity. Then it would make a big difference whether we said Kenneth Rice was going to spend everything on his wife and daughters versus, no, Ken Rice was a miser. He made his wife and his kids shop at the thrift store, and they lived on skim milk and tuna fish, kind of like a law student. And that's all that they would have been able to enjoy. So, what's the reality of our case? As I said, in this case, it doesn't matter whether you put it on this side or you live it on that side. It's all going into the same pocket. But again, you can easily imagine cases in which it would be bitterly fought as between the folks that say, no, it belongs on this side, it belongs on that side. In many ways, it's the same conversation we had with respect to Mrs. O'Shea. How long was she going to work? Was she getting promoted? Was she just about to get fired? Had she told all her friends 2 weeks earlier she hated her job and she was going to quit as soon as she got enough money to pay off her visa bill? Where are we in terms of this history and the projection into the future? In this case, and even more so in the next case, you may feel we've left the realm of actual adjudication and we've entered into a new career as a fiction writer. You know, we're making it up with respect to what Mr. Rice would have done. Kept his job, become president of the company, a rising star in the corporate world, a drug addict, just about to get fired, you know. Where, you know, again, depending upon the evidence here, it makes a huge difference in terms of the outcome of the case. Okay, so that's the economic award. What does Pennsylvania provide by way of non-economic damages? Nothing. It's a good thing in this case that Mr. Rice had a healthy income. It's pretty old. This is back in the 60s. You know, it's 1964. He's making $25,000 a year. That was pretty good money then. Suppose he had just been about to board a plane celebrating his retirement from the company. He wasn't planning on laying any more eggs. Does that mean there's no damage? I would think not. Here, Mr. Rice is valued for his economic contribution, but there's nothing here that would compensate his family for the loss of Ken Rice, human being. Suppose it were reversed, and instead of Ken Rice killed, it's one of his daughters that's killed. And the sister and the mother and the father are the beneficiaries claiming wrongful death. Does a daughter or a son, for that matter, constitute an economic loss if they're killed prematurely? No. None of us has kids thinking we're going to make money on them. Does that mean they're, good thing for you. Gee, the Rice family really lost a lot, but good thing for you, you didn't really have a loss there. Well, that's crazy. And yet, if you were the court looking at this, if it were a case that had no economic loss, and the legislature seems to have left out any compensation for non-economic loss, what could you do as a court? Do you simply say, gee, I'm terribly sorry to the family, but I'm as outraged as you are, but I can't do anything. Please go talk to the legislature. Get this thing fixed. I'd be the first to vote for it. I would help run your campaign, but gee, there's nothing I can do. Or does the judge begin to look in, you know, whatever there is in the statute that might provide something that would justify a recovery? Even if it's, we're stretching the language a little bit here to make it fit. So, for example, what does it say here? It specifically says that the widow is entitled to the amount of the pecuniary loss. I'm reading here, this is on page 46, right-hand column. This is the opinion in Fern versus Chatterton. The amount of pecuniary loss, what's pecuniary loss? Pecuniary means money. I'm impecunious means I have no money. So the pecuniary loss is the money loss. I assume we're talking about economic loss there. Present value of earnings. Without any allowance for mental suffering, grief, or loss of companionship. Okay, that's pretty clear. But supposing the statute simply says that the family is entitled to the pecuniary damages from the loss. It doesn't explicitly exclude mental suffering, loss of companionship. Suppose it refers to the loss of support. I lose my child in a tragic accident. My child is 12 years old. I claim that I lost the support of my child. Did my child support me financially? No way. But my child supported me emotionally. When I come home at the end of the day wondering if any of it's worthwhile, I see my child and think, oh yeah, maybe it is worthwhile. I lose my child, suddenly my reason for being disappear. Can I then seek pecuniary damages? Well, hey, what are pecuniary damages? They're money damages, aren't they? I'm asking for money, so those are pecuniary damages. For the support I've lost from my child, will a judge give me that? Maybe. Again, the judge will be reluctant to look the parent in the eye and say, gee, the statute has given you nothing for the loss of your child, even though you've proved it's a result of the defendant's negligence. At the same time, the judge can't make something appear out of nothing. If there's a previous case like this one that describes what can be recovered and what can't be recovered, well, the judge is going to shrug his or her shoulders and say, I'm stuck. Go talk to the Court of Appeals, maybe, but this is the hand of cards I've been dealt. So again, you see what's going on here in terms of, on the one hand, the generosity of the statute, including both the wrongful death and the survival statute recovery, but at the same time, the real stinginess of the statute, its seeming incomprehension of the fact that in many cases the decedent wasn't an economic asset, but why should that mean there's no compensation for wrongfully taking the life of that decedent? You can see again the frustration in having this taken out of the hands of the courts and consigned solely to the legislature. And the legislature writes something up in 1868 or in 1912 or whenever it is, and they say, well, this is the best we can do. And in 2003, a court has to interpret it and figure out, what does this mean? What should it mean? Now, Mr. Johnson asked earlier, well, what's all this stuff aside from economic loss? And I think the answer is, again, I mean, the answer that I would give as to why, as a judge, I would be tempted to find some way to compensate is, I just think it's wrong to tell a parent, in effect, you haven't been harmed. Go ahead. Okay. But notice the logic. This is where the logic of these statutes takes on a life of its own. If our focus is on the relatives who survive, we say, what is their loss? Their loss economically, their loss emotionally, non-economically. On the other hand, if our focus is on the survival of the cause of action, what we're trying to do is say, in effect, this lawsuit represents the decedent. This is the decedent being compensated as best we can. Of course, we're not going to stuff dollar bills into the casket or something. That would be wrong. But we're doing the next best thing. We're stuffing the estate with compensation that he would have deserved had he lived, and then we're giving it to the people he wanted to give his estate to. And that's exactly what we do with Nancy Feldman, which we need to get to here in a moment, but before we leave Mr. Rice and his family, just so you kind of see the pattern here, notice too that the court looks at this stream of future income and then discounts it back to present value, same kind of operation we talked about in O'Shea. You don't need to crunch the numbers, but again, this process of projecting out the income and then reducing that stream of projected future income to a dollar amount cash value today. Other questions about First National Bank of Meadville, Ms. Olmsted. Well, I mean, the language of this opinion that the court is quoting, there's no way you can say, oh, I'm just following what they told us to do here. You've got to overrule that case. Now, this court, I think, is sitting in diversity, applying the law of another state, and when you sit in diversity and you use the law of the state, you know, all this Erie versus Tompkins, and again, you'll do all this wonderful stuff, I believe, next semester, if I've got the sequence right in civil procedure. You haven't done Erie versus Tompkins? Oh, you do? Oh, okay. Well, this is the deal then. How do you choose the law, and then a federal judge looking at that law may say, oh, this is a case from 1862. I don't think today's Pennsylvania Supreme Court would, I think they would overrule this case. Judges can do that. The other thing we'll see, for example, in Harbison, if you've read as far as Harbison is another diversity case, not diversity, it's a Federal Tort Claims Act case, but the judge has to apply the law of Washington. The judge trying to apply the law of Washington says, I haven't the foggiest idea what these people would do. I know. I'll write to the Washington Supreme Court. Certifies the question to the Washington Supreme Court, says, basically, I'm stuck. Federal judges rarely do that. They do the best they can. Even where the law is a little bit hazy, they'll make a stab as best they can to say, I think this is what the law in the state of Washington is. I may be right, I may be wrong, but this seems to me the right rule. But again, as in Harbison, they say, I don't know where to begin. Please, you write this on this blank sheet of paper, in effect. So, again, the judge, in trying to project what is the law, may wind up saying, in effect, yeah, it says this, but I'm confident this case would be overruled, it would be disregarded, it would be distinguished. It simply is so bad, I can't feature a court in 2003 following. But I don't think there's any way to avoid taking it straight on. You can't say, oh, yeah, we're working with this here. We're just, you know, reinterpreting. You can do that a little bit better with a statute than you can with a case, because cases tend to be more explicit about where they're going. Mr. Brown. Well, there, I've been told, I'm not a real whiz on this stuff, I've been told that there's some double counting going on here, that they actually count the pre-trial loss twice, and I take people's word for that. My emphasis is not on the details of exactly how they counted, but on the overall process of seeing how it works. Now, the reason they do it in both cases, because that's what the statute says. As I said earlier, in this case, it really doesn't matter whether you give it directly to the wife and children and daughters over here, or whether you give it to the estate, who in turn gives it to the wife and daughters. But going through this process would matter, and the judge would probably do it anyway, just as a matter of form, because who knows? It may turn out that this will's no good. There's a new will that somebody uncovered, and now it turns out the money that's going into the estate isn't going to the wife and daughters, it's going to the Humane Society or somebody else. So the judge is going to follow the statute, even if it appears that it doesn't matter. It's actually kind of a nice little segue to Feldman, because the judge in Feldman says, what does it matter? Earnings from her law practice, the loss of the ability to enjoy staying at home with her children, I don't care. It's all the same. And the appellate court says, no, that doesn't quite work. We've got to stick to the filling in the boxes here. Okay, other questions about Niagara therapy before we move on to Feldman? Okay, again, just another example, wrongful death case. How do you pick up the statute and project or predict the measure of damages and who the beneficiaries are going to be? So, somebody want to tell us about Feldman, or can we go ahead? Okay, go ahead. Yes. And again, as we did with Mrs. O'Shea, or as we did with Kenneth Rice, we try to look into the future and make intelligent predictions about what this was going to look like financially. And obviously, she's going to go into the deficit position here, paying for law school, and then hopefully this is going to turn around into income. And we try as best we can, based on the evidence, to figure out what kind of lawyer was she going to be. Did she say she wanted to do public interest work? Did she say she wanted to be a prosecuting attorney? Did she say she wanted to do high-profile criminal defense? Did she want to do mergers and acquisitions? What did she want to do? And did she have the characteristics, the profile of somebody that makes it plausible to think that this is a reasonably accurate forecast of the future? Again, you may look at this and say, man, this is fiction writing here. And you'd be right to some extent. At the same time, as I've said before, compared to what? What else would we do? Now, before we get into the specifics of the case, let's pull back for just a second and ask the question, first of all, what state's law governs the measure of damages here? Yeah, it's Connecticut law. Why, I'm not entirely sure, but I guess they were living in Connecticut when the plane crash occurred. The plane crash occurred in New Haven, so there may be a number of factors that made Connecticut appropriate. It may also have been desirable from the plaintiff's standpoint because of the way it measures damages. And how does Connecticut say we should compensate in cases of wrongful death? First of all, what are the two questions we want to ask? But before we get there, as we pick up the statute, we want to ask two fundamental questions. And what do they get? So let's answer those. Under Connecticut law, who is the entity or person to be compensated? Is Connecticut a wrongful death type statute, or is it a survival type statute? No, I don't think so. I think it's more of a, again, it's confusing because we use the term wrongful death to refer generically to people who get killed through somebody's negligence or a breach of duty. But when we refer to a type which is either it benefits the family or it benefits the estate, Connecticut seems to say it is a survival action, it benefits the estate. So as with Kenneth, Mr. Brown. Well, except it's not the value of the estate she would have left. Remember that in the case of Kenneth Rice, we send most of the compensation to the wife and daughters, and then we look at the estate he would have left at the end of his life. Here, what we're saying is the value of her life as a whole, both her earning potential, as well as this answering the what question. Not only do you get the economic loss, but you get the non-economic loss to her. It's what she forfeited, what was taken away from her, because her life was cut short. So again, now it's confusing, as with the Rice case, because it turns out both sets of beneficiaries are the same. That is, Reed Feldman shows up, he's the spouse, but it also turns out he's the executor of her estate. So he's there to claim on her behalf the value of her life. And oh, by the way, he's the beneficiary of the estate. What you will. Yeah. Well, this is another reason why it's useful to go look at the past exams, because you get an opportunity. You'll see several different wrongful death statutes, and as you pick up and read them, you will hopefully get some impression, which you can kind of, you work from what you know to what you don't know. What I know is that this statute talks in terms of, the recovery for wrongful death is to be distributed to the spouse, if any, and if no spouse, then the children, if any, of the decedent. Okay, that's, when I see that, I get the impression we're talking about a so-called wrongful death statute. The loss is measured in terms of spouse, children, parents, siblings, etc. As distinguished from picking up the statute and reading that the loss is to compensate the decedent's estate for the loss of the decedent's earning capacity, capacity to enjoy life, etc. Now, nothing prevents the legislature, as in the Pennsylvania case, from mixing and matching. They may say, I like a little bit of this, but I like a little bit of that. And if so, you look at the statute and you say, gee, it looks like the legislature's trying to kind of have it both ways. They can do other things. Legislatures can. They can put a cap on damages. They can say the amount of the loss, but in no case shall it exceed such and so. Can't be more than $500,000 or $50,000 or some other arbitrary limit. The legislature can, whatever. I'm just trying to be the messenger here from the legislature to my client to say it looks to me as though the jurisdiction that we're in has chosen this method of compensation, and in particular trying to answer the who question. So if I'm the Humane Society and I've been working with this rich guy for a long time, and I suddenly read in the paper that he died, and as I understand it, he was leaving a lot of his money. It turns out he died in a plane crash. And I want to show up and find out, well, what's the deal here? Am I entitled to the wrongful death recovery, or is that by statute pledged not to some charity? Under this statute, it goes to spouse, if there is one, children, if there is one, et cetera, et cetera. Ms. McLaughlin. Yes. Yeah, and limit them, too. So it may say, you get all your economic loss, but as to that non-economic loss, let's not get carried away. Let's put a cap on that. So, again, as we have seen in other areas, legislatures tend to operate by way of compromise. This interest over here wants something, and there's another interest that wants something very different, and what happens with the legislation, it gets split down the middle in some way. So again, one of the frustrating things about this is that the legislature, although in theory they have all their wits about them, legislatures don't always have their wits about them, and courts have to kind of pick up the pieces. To the extent, again, you're looking at something that's relatively old, relatively well established, we have case law interpreting it, we have a fairly good basis upon which to draw a reliable conclusion, but then again, we may not. So, again, I recognize that I give you quite a challenge on the exam to try to figure out what has this legislature said they want, but, gee, that's not unusual for you. In the real world, you might actually go forum shopping to say, I've got a plane crash case where there are three or four different possibilities of where I might choose to bring this action, and which of these do I think would provide me the best angle for my client? And I got to pick up these statutes and make whatever sense I can, read the annotations and so forth. I want to spend just a few minutes talking about the specific part of Feldman. Again, we talked about it earlier. The trial judge said, well, in theory, she would, again, writing our novelette here, about the life of Nancy Feldman, we project that she would have had, you know, 2.3 children. They would have spent, she would have spent 8 years out of the workforce again. You might look at this and laugh, thinking, gee, that's 1975. In 2003, women who have children typically don't leave the workforce. So that it, to suggest that her earnings would be reduced to zero or even reduced substantially doesn't fit. What I would say on that point is remember that we're not engaged in making social policy with respect to Nancy Feldman. We don't care whether she's just been listening to Dr. Laura or what it is she's doing. She gets to decide what it is she wants to do. And if she wanted to work, she wanted to have kids, she wanted to do this, she wanted to do that, that's her choice. We're just trying to decide for the sake of the estate, what did she lose? What did she lose by way of income? What did she lose by way of non-remunerative activities? Again, Connecticut is a much better place if your client is a disabled, mentally retarded person who was the love of the family that he or she was part of, but didn't make a dime. In Pennsylvania, that's viewed as no harm, no foul. In Connecticut, at least, that person would be able, if they can enjoy life, they're entitled to damages, and their estate would be able to get some. So, again, in one sense, you're, and I want to emphasize what you're doing when you pick this up on the exam. Don't think that I'm expecting you instantly to read the statute and say, well, of course, this means such and so and such and so. Oftentimes, it's a little bit murky. That's fine. Tell your client, I'm having difficulty coming down on one side or the other with respect to this phrase, whether pecuniary damages just means economic loss or whether it might include an award for non-economic damages. But what I can tell you is if it means this, we're in trouble, and if it means that, we've got a shot at it. Or I'm not sure whether the Humane Society is entitled to any remedy at all. Maybe this phrase allows them to collect, but then again, maybe this phrase over here suggests that they can't. So again, as you report back to your client, I'm not expecting you to be clairvoyant, but this, in fact, is what lawyers wind up doing, is making the best judgment they can about issues and also drawing upon their past experience to say, in these cases, courts did this, that, and the other thing. Maybe they do the same thing here. So we'll pick up with, there's a little note here that I want to start with tomorrow on, it's actually at the end of the chapter, I think. Do I have some reference there? I think to, it's the California, the Gray Davis material. Isn't that at the end of your chapter? The end of chapter 3? The idea of domestic partnerships and whether or not those get classed with other entities for purposes of compensation. We'll begin there briefly, but then move on to the wrongful birth, wrongful life stuff.